Welcome to Wild Trekker. I'm George Toombs here in Montreal, and this is episode 11. By the way, Wild Trekker is a series of weekly 50-minute podcasts, a happening, like dipping into a writer's notebook. Wild Trekker presents audio chapters from ongoing works, soundscapes, adventures, interviews, reflections, original plays, stories behind stories, jam sessions with musicians, and more. Wild Trekker is a fluid kind of sound art. Imagine this scene. In the hour before dawn, a common blackbird is perched on the branch of an oak tree in a forest in Europe. A species of true thrush, the blackbird is warbling, trilling, singing liquid melodies. This is a scene that inspired composer Emily Doolittle to write her doctoral thesis at Princeton University on the music of blackbirds and humpback whales, but also to compose an original chamber piece reproducing some blackbird melodies. That piece is called Night Blackbird Song. I interviewed Emily Doolittle a few years ago, just after she received her doctorate. But the interview has a lot to say to us today about the secret music in the animal world. So, Emily, you just received your PhD from Princeton University. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Am I allowed to call you Dr. Doolittle now?
Well, when I defended my dissertation afterwards, I wrote all my friends and I said, you have 24 hours to make all the Dr. Doolittle jokes you want, and then that's it. So I think you're actually past the expiry date for Dr. Doolittle jokes.
But if your PhD dissertation at Princeton is devoted to understanding the music made by different kinds of animals, you may have something in common with Hugh Lofting's Dr. Doolittle.
I guess so. The funny thing is, you know, all my life I've heard Dr. Doolittle jokes. So, of course, I'm used to thinking of that. But I was actually working on my dissertation for 6 months before it occurred to me that, oh no, I'm actually doing something Dr. Doolittle related.
Was there any experience in your life which set you on this track of trying to understand whether birds are able to actually compose music? They don't just make automatic sounds, but they're actually composing new songs.
There's sort of a whole collection of experiences which led me in this direction. One is that about, I guess, 9 years ago, I was living in Amsterdam, and early on when I moved there, I woke up in the middle of the night because I heard this beautiful bird singing outside my window. And since I was in a new place, of course, the bird was unfamiliar to me, and I was really fascinated by it. So I sort of threw open the window and listened for quite a long time. And one of the things that really interested me was that a lot of what the bird sang, it turned out to be a European blackbird, I found out the next day, but a lot of the small motives that it sang were very much like what people use in music, but the way it strung them together was very unlike any human music I knew. And I was really interested in thinking about the difference between the way a blackbird and a human would combine similar motives. I ended up exploring that in a piece called Night Blackbird Song, and it also sort of became an ongoing thing for me to think about. Other things that sort of influenced me, I guess, to be curious about whether animals might make music. At one point I read Next of Kin by Roger Fuchs, which was talking about sort of sign language communication with chimpanzees, and I was really fascinated to learn the extent to which chimpanzees really can learn and use human language effectively. And another thing that contributed to that interest was just in traveling, sort of observing how different animals actually behave differently in different countries. For example, in Greece and in Mediterranean Europe, I've noticed that cats will follow people around and follow them into restaurants and beg for food, whereas in North America, street cats tend to be sort of more shy and, you know, they just interact with people in a completely different way. And I noticed that in Finland, people feed squirrels, and consequently the squirrels will follow people around and be very friendly, and they actually move much slower when they're approaching people than the squirrels here, which are always running around and jumping and really never approaching people. So sort of a whole combination of things led to my interest.
Why do you think it's difficult for humans to conceive of animals having culture?
Gosh, that's a question with sort of a long history. There's all kinds of forces in this sort of Western culture suggesting that we should think of humans as completely different from other animals, sort of forces coming from religions and from Greek thought and from sort of early scientific thinking.
It's too big a question, actually. Okay. Do you think your own training as a musician helped you to put together what that blackbird was singing that night back in Amsterdam? To listen to it. Did your experience as a composer yourself help you to put together what that blackbird was singing in Amsterdam?
Yeah, I guess in a way, although classical music culture generally would not be open to the idea that, or a lot of classical musicians would not be open to the idea that maybe animals are making some sort of music also. But I remember about 15 years ago talking with a conductor about the whole idea of animal songs, bird songs, whether they might be music or not. And he was saying, well, you know, it sounds like music, but really it's just a mating call, so it can't be, or it's just a territorial call or something like that, so it can't be music at all. But I always sort of wondered about that. So I would say things that my musical training made me think about definitely led to my being curious how the blackbird song was put together and you know, considering it as something possibly musical. But, you know, if you get a standard conservatory education, it's certainly not going to be suggesting that you should think of bird songs as something musical.
Aren't human love ballads a form of mating call?
Well, yeah, that's one thing. I think in this culture, we have a tendency to think of animal songs as something purely functional and biological, and of human music as something purely aesthetic and creative and beautiful. But I think if we actually look at what's going on in animal songs and in human songs, we'll find that animal songs aren't all completely explained by functionality, and that lots of human songs do have some functional purpose. And, of course, there's love songs and sexy rock stars, national anthems, team songs, all kinds of things that could, just as much as any animal song, be said to be about mating or territoriality or that sort of thing.
Could you tell me a little bit about what you learned when you started to investigate different types of bird song? Which direction did that take you in? Did you see different species doing different things, or are there some species of birds which seem to be more creative to you than others?
Yeah, one of the things that amazed me is just the diversity of ways in which birds learn and create and sort of shape their songs. I think sometimes as humans we tend to think there's people and there's birds, but actually there's many, many species of bird, and each species of bird is very different from the other. So we really have to look at each individual species song rather than bird songs in general. Definitely there's some species that are more musical than others. For me, a part of something being musical would be that there'd be some sort of learned and some sort of learned element, and also an element of choice. And there are birds which don't learn their songs. They have instinctive songs, or birds which never vary those songs, that never vary their songs. And I would tend to think of those as not musical, or at least very much less musical than the species in which birds are learning their songs as young birds and constantly reshaping them and gathering new material and putting it together in different ways.
If you think over the range of human civilization, there are many, many cases where in the historical stories we tell each other and our sacred stories, birds have come to announce something important to us. And why is it difficult for some people, given this tradition over time of seeing birds able to communicate things to us or to announce things to us, why is it so difficult for some people to admit that birds may actually be capable of improvising, of composing, of creating music rather than just automatically singing the same old tune once and again?
Well, I think in a lot of these myths, actually, birds are symbolic rather than individual birds. For example, there's the myth of a bird having sung Gregorian chant to, I guess, Saint Gregory. That's supposed to have been the origin of Gregorian chant. Anyway, in that case, the bird was symbolic. It wasn't really an individual bird, but it was sort of a symbolic bird carrying the voice of God. So I think that, I don't know, in this culture, maybe we are open to the idea of birds as symbols. Also, like if you look at a composer like Messiaen, he was also using birds very symbolically, as sort of, he considered them to be, the most purest, beautiful form of music. And but I think what we're more reluctant to do is to consider each individual bird as a creative and subjective being whose voice is worth listening to.
When I listen to a blackbird in Europe or a robin here in Canada or even a cardinal, I can't help feeling this bird is singing out of a sense of joy and wonderment. It's just such a powerful song that I'm listening to, and it changes so much if you listen carefully to it. How do you feel about that?
I tend to feel that must be the case also. And there's definitely lots of ornithologists and naturalists over, the past several hundred years, many hundred years, who've thought that also. There's sort of two streams, I guess, in science and ornithology and things. On the one hand, people who are open to the idea that birds and other animals may be experiencing really similar emotions to what we're doing. And then on the other hand, you have sort of scientists who are completely unwilling to admit that an animal might be feeling any emotion, or that animals would actually be able to feel anything.
Thank you.
possible that we simply cannot understand what birds are singing or the way they feel, simply because we project our own human emotions and rationality onto other species and end up sort of stumped?
Yeah, I think sometimes we make the mistake of, I mean, it's true that each species is very different from our own, so of course we can't know exactly what they're thinking or feeling. Just as we can't really know exactly what another person is thinking or feeling, we can feel like we have a good idea of it, but we'll never know exactly what it's like to be them, and we'll never know exactly what it's like to be another species. But I think that some people make the mistake of thinking that since we can't know exactly what a bird is thinking or feeling, it must not be thinking or feeling anything. But that seems like a big mistake to me. And given, I mean, of course, we are very different from other species, but we're also all animals, and there's lots of things we have in common. And to me, it makes more sense to assume that many animals would be thinking and feeling things, and that some of the emotions would be similar to our own, even though, of course, they would be different also, and we can't know for sure. But it just seems like a big mistake to assume that because we can't know what animals, you know, what they're thinking or feeling, that they must therefore not be thinking or feeling anything.
Could you tell me about some of the other animals that you studied, for example, elephants?
Yeah, well, of the animals that make sounds that I would consider to be music or possibly musical, by far the majority of them are birds, but there are some mammals that that have songs that seem to me very musical also, and we're sort of still learning a lot, so there may be many more mammals whose songs we just don't know much about. But among the mammals who definitely make musical sounds would be, whales and dolphins, possibly bats. Bats sing very high ultrasonic songs, which are learned and quite variable. And then there's some animals that aren't really known to make music in the wild, but have done things very much like music in captivity. They may do it in the wild also, and we don't know about. And one of these is elephants. In Thailand, there's a ensemble of elephants called the Thai Elephant Orchestra. This arose because, I guess, elephants used to be used for logging in Thailand. And when the logging industry sort of dried up, there were all these unemployed elephants with no means of earning money for them to be kept. And so some people who were interested in sort of helping the elephants were trying to come up with other ideas for the way, you know, ways they could earn money to help the elephants. In the past, people have done various things with elephant paintings and selling the paintings and raising that money that way. And these people, I think composer Dave Soldier is one of them, had the idea of building some large musical instruments for the elephants to play and to see if the elephants would be interested in doing that. And they found that they were very interested in playing the instruments. And what was really interesting was that they actually approached the instruments very similar to ways that humans would approach instruments. For example, they would sort of try out one note. A lot of the instruments were sort of very large, very strong xylophone type instruments, and the elephants would try one note and explore it for a long time. Then they'd add another note and explore both notes, and they'd sort of add things one at a time rather than trying everything all at once. And they found that certain elephants ended up developing favorite instruments and favorite sort of passages that they'd play. And one thing that seemed really interesting to me, apparently some of the xylophones were built in they had a Thai musical scale, but there was one extra note. And apparently the elephants were very wary about playing the extra note. They were more likely to play the notes that were in the Thai scale. So that suggests perhaps they recognized a correspondence between, between the instrument they were playing and music they had heard. There's been other experiments done with elephants, just showing that they have really good recognition of melodies, not just immediate, but they remember them over years, and that they're sensitive to pitches, whether they're transposed or not. Maybe in the last 10 or 20 years, elephants have been discovered to communicate with infrasonic sounds. These are too low for people to hear. So although elephants haven't been known to make music in the wild, it's also possible that they're doing things that we actually just don't know about. Elephants are known to imitate other elephants and sounds in the environment, and to me that's often something that goes along with music making.
Now, there are many different types of whales, and we are now able to record whale songs and to listen to them. What have you learned about whales and the diversity of whales?
Well, humpback whales are, of course, the best-known whale singers, and the way they put together their songs is quite remarkable and very much like the way human composers might put together songs, slightly different patterns, but... you know, there's sort of a gradual, constant change in humpback whale songs and sort of various processes they actually go through to be transformed. One thing that became really clear to me while doing this research is just how little we know. There's evidence that many other of the baleen whales may also have songs as interesting and complex as those of the humpback whales, you know, blue whales and right whales, for example, but they've been very little studied. So we actually, I guess recently it's been discovered that some of their songs may also be undergoing this gradual change and sort of play an equally important role in the life of the whales, but we actually know very little about it.
Could you tell me a little more about humpbacks? How do they put together the song, and how many different animals do you think are going to be singing a similar song? And is it by region, or how does it work?
Yeah, well, for humpback whales, it's very interesting. In each ocean basin, all the whales will be singing the same song, but the song will be gradually changing. The song's made up of, say 5 to 9 different themes, and each theme can be repeated any number of times, or it can be left out, but each of the themes... they must always be sung in the same order. So if the themes are A, B, C, D, and E, the whale could sing A, B, 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 C, E, 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 but it could never sing A, C, B, D, E. And then within, you know, these songs, the themes are actually gradually transforming. And again, they're sort of set patterns according to which they transform. Like a typical pattern might be first the whale would sing something like a glissando, say going upwards, and then some of the pitches in between would be taken out, so it would sound more like a scalar passage going up, and then maybe some more notes would be taken out, and it would sound more like a arpeggio going upwards, and then eventually it might just be the note at the beginning and the end, and then, you know, perhaps the whale might go on to change it by repeating the starting note or repeating the ending note or something like that, and eventually it would transform into a whole new theme. So if you heard the song a couple years later, you might not recognize what had become of a theme, but if you were listening to all the songs in between, you could see how it transformed.
Thank you.
some way, but I don't think that we've found the way at all. Scientists have a whole mix of theories of why the humpbacks might be singing, but none of those really seem that plausible.
What is your gut feeling when you listen to humpback songs? What do you believe?
Well, I guess it's very easy for me to believe that humpback whales are doing something like composing music, and probably like human music, there's a whole variety of complex reasons that they're doing it. We can't say it's only one thing.
And do their songs travel through the water?
Yeah, they travel quite a distance. I don't know how far it is, but yeah.
Now, tell me something. You've mentioned some of the different species that you've studied, and you've mentioned our own limitations in understanding what these other species may be expressing, while you can recognize musical forms and you can analyze what they are singing. How does this impact on you as a human musician? What have you learned from the experience of studying animal music?
Well, when, you know, certainly listening to all the animal songs has had some influence on my own music. I have some pieces that sort of directly imitate bird songs, and others that sort of have made up bird songs in them. But beyond that, I feel like some of the way animal songs are structured have affected my music. I feel like often bird songs, well, I mean, each species is different, but in many species, there's a lot of silence in the songs, and there's sort of a rhythm of you hear some motives, and then there's some space, and you hear other motives. And I think my music is moving in that direction. I often find that what I'm really interested in, you know, say what I'm listening to, shows up in my music 4 or 5 years later. So I think that probably over the next few years, I'll find that my music has been even more influenced by animal songs, but already they're creeping in there. I wrote Night Blackbird Song in 1999 when I was living in Amsterdam. When I first moved there, I woke up one night in the middle of the night to hear a beautiful bird singing outside my window. And because I was in a new place and just sort of very keenly aware of what was around me, I threw open the window and listened for a long time. And I was really fascinated by sort of comparing what the bird was singing to what I'm used to in human music. I found that a lot of the small motives that it sang were very much like what humans use in music. There are little scalar passages and little arpeggios and things like that. But the way the blackbird strung the motives together was very much unlike what I'm used to humans doing in music. So I thought about this for a long time, and I ended up exploring it in, you know, through a composition of my own, like Blackbird Song. And what I did was I sort of made up a whole collection of motives. Some of them were copied directly from blackbirds. I went and listened to I listened to the blackbird by my house, and there's a blackbird by a friend's house, and I went and listened to that blackbird. So I collected some actual blackbird motives, and I made some motives that sounded like they could be blackbird motives. And then in the piece, I sort of start out by arranging the motives as I imagine that a blackbird would. So sort of, you know, lots of repetitions, just sort of jumping from one motive to the other without any connecting melodic or harmonic material, sort of, you know, sound followed by silence in a pattern that doesn't necessarily make sense to humans. But gradually throughout the course of the piece, I transformed them, using the same motives, I transformed them into something that's more the way I'm used to humans arranging music. So there was sort of more patterns, the way things were repeated, more transition between the different motives, sort of harmonic connection between different passages, but it's the same motives throughout.
When you learn to listen in a new way to bird song or whale song, do you personally feel more connected to nature?
Yes, I do. I think for me it's really important that we come to recognize animals as individuals rather than just like a whole class. And, you know, when we see a bird, we think, oh, there's that bird, not there's one of all those birds or something like that. So I think, yeah, focusing on animal songs and sort of the individuality, you know, that many singing animals express, I think it's really helped me sort of connect the ideas of individual animals as subjective individuals rather than, you know, just part of a group.
Do you think that the animals have a sense of the beautiful and of aesthetics?
I mean, that's something we certainly don't know, but I don't think we have a good reason to believe that they don't. So I think we're probably safer believing that they do.
Thank you very much. Emily Doolittle?
Now, there are many ways of composing music which evokes the song of whales. I remember camping on the pink granite shore at Les Bergerins on the lower St. Lawrence River. We laid out our sleeping bags on the granite outside of the tent because it was so warm in mid-July. The sky was filled with millions of stars, and I distinctly remember, an hour before dawn, seeing the Pleiades and Capella, the bright star in Auriga, and Saturn with its rings tilted at an odd angle, and next to it Aldebaran, the bright star in Taurus, and then, lower towards the horizon, Jupiter and Venus. Through the night, waves roll in on the beach, but far off in the distance, we can make out a cheerful sound. But what is it? Could it be people partying? Or a group of insomniacs standing around a campfire? No, it proves to be a pod of beluga whales, the little milky white whales that live year-round in the Gulf and estuary of the St. Lawrence in eastern Canada. Singer-songwriter Marie Frenette wrote the following song, in French, to commemorate our night together under the stars.
Et j'entendis un chant dans la nuit, ou le cri d'un enfant, une sirène. Et j'entendis le vent qui s'ennuie. Est-ce dans ma tête, moi qui croyais la mer endormie, j'entends comme un écho une chorale. Je n'ai pas fermé l'œil de la nuit. Est-ce dans ma tête, et ce souffle qui perce la mer cristalline. Comme l'aube se change en lumière opaline. Je n'en crois rien, pourtant elles se parlent et répondent. Je les entends et porte-voix en écho. Bien des marins ont voulu raconter sa légende. Nul n'en croit rien, engourdi par le charme et l'air sale.
Wow. Thanks to you, Marie. That was lovely. The Inuit of Arctic Canada know various species of seal through and through. There are harp seals in the Arctic, and ringed seals, and bearded seals, and northern sea lions, and occasionally gray seals. Young Inuit women love to do bouts of throat singing, in which they derive an extraordinary kind of guttural, rhythmic vocal music from the cry of seals. Two women face each other and launch a kind of throat singing contest to see who ends up losing concentration first and then bursts out laughing. I recorded Kathy Keknek and Robin Ikutisluk throat singing in Joe Haven, Nunavut. Possible to reproduce the rhythms of Inuit throat singing on another instrument, say the harp? Well, here's an experiment I do on the harp, just to see what happens. Brad Hurley shows in the next piece that it's possible to play a reel on the penny whistle accompanying Inuit throat singing. Wow. And in this jazz rendition, Cameron Wallace on the saxophone joins David Carbonneau on the trumpet and Gilles Hébert on percussion in a different kind of sound experience. And by the way, I recorded these jazz pieces for my forthcoming feature film, The Blinding Sea. To think that all this music started off with a seal pup on a beach calling to its mother. That's the sound of trumpeter swans in the Yukon. Here, finally, is a free jazz accompaniment. Cameron Wallace on the saxophone joins David Carbonneau on the trumpet and Gilles Hébert on percussion. There, after all this time, we're back to Montreal. Here we are in 2019. If you would like to know more about Emily Doolittle's chamber piece, Night Blackbird Song, you can find information on the website of the Society of Composers. That's www.societyofcomposersinoneword.org/publications/cdseries.html. If you would like to know more about my ongoing creative works, from books, literary translations, films, and blogs to Wild Trekker, check out my author's website at www.evidencia.net. And Evidencia is spelled Evidentia, Evidencia. You can also drop me a line on the contact page on that website. This Wild Trekker episode is copyright 2019, George Toombs, all rights reserved. Now here's Marie Frenette singing the closing theme of Wild Trekker, accompanied by Pascal Desmeules on the guitar. Let's get together soon. Bye for now.